From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Tom Sherwood, welcome.
Good afternoon.
Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with Calvin Ball, the Howard County executive. Joining us in studio now is Kanik Aguirre. He is an Alexandria City Council member. Kanik Aguirre, thank you very much for joining us.
Great to be back.
First up, Tom Sherwood, what's going on with the D.C. lottery and sports gambling contract? The Washington Post did an apparently exhaustive investigation of the company that is supposed to be the subcontractor, the contractor being the Greek company Intralot, the subcontractor being a company known as Veterans Services Corporation. Turns out that apparently Veterans Services Corporation's work would be performed by a company called DC09, but apparently DC09 was formed by and is controlled by Intralot. What's going on?
Well, these seem to be sham subcontractors to Intralot, which is the big gaming firm out of Greece. First of all, the story was well documented by Steve Thompson for the Washington Post. I want to give him credit for it. And this is another blow to this contract. And we had a big fight earlier this winter and spring in the city about whether and how the city would go forward with sports betting. Intralot runs the city's lottery, and it wanted to control sports betting. The CFO of the city, Jeffrey, his name went out of my head. Anyway,
Jeffrey DeWitt.
DeWitt. I knew it started to say someone else's name.
Don't know why wanted, I remember
said,
this.
Look, we want to get off the ground quickly. Let's do a sole source contract. Let's move ahead. Intralot's in place. It can do it. And the council was very close vote, allowed it to go forward. And now that shows that this Veterans Services Corporation essentially is a nothing contract. The person who controls it is actually employed or gets money from Intralot in a different way. So it's a mess. And I had just spoken this, not spoken, but texted with Councilmember Silverman this morning, Alyssa Silverman, who was opposed to the sole source contract. She says she is now talking to the Attorney General, Carl Racine, about whether or not the council can bring this thing back up in the next couple of weeks and maybe put a halt on it till we figure out what's going on and maybe move away from sole source contracting and put it out for bid for other people who might want to do it. So it's a big blow to sports betting in the city, which just this week released the rules and regulations for businesses that want to do sports betting.
On to the Commonwealth of Virginia, where in Fairfax County, the Virginia State Police are opening an investigation into Fairfax County board member Jeff McKay. Why?
Well, the allegation from a former opponent is that he did some favors in order of some zoning favors that, and then ended up getting a house built at a reduced cost. He says this is political smear, there's nothing to it. McKay says he'll fight it, and that's where it stands.
Alexandria City staff are exploring the idea of closing off part of King Street to car traffic to make the area, which leads directly into Waterfront Park, more walkable. What do you think about this project, and how do you balance the needs of all the different people using roads, including pedestrians, cyclists, and drivers, especially in such a high-traffic area?
Well, let's not forget the scooters, right?
Yeah, I was about to get to that, but go ahead.
No, I think, you know, it's a good idea. If anybody's ever been down there during peak times, you see how many people are walking and crossing traffic, and the cars just start to get backed up because they can't make turns because they have to cede the path to pedestrians. I think the one major thing that we have to take into consideration is those with disabilities and some of our senior populations. How do they access that last two blocks, right? Because we could get parking for everybody further up and not give access to vehicles. How do we get everybody else down there? Potentially maybe letting the trolley keep on going down there. So it's still something that we're talking about, and I believe the mayor and Councilman Chapman have brought it forward. So I'm looking forward to doing it. And we already have one example from a festival, a car festival that we had. I think earlier this year, and it went really, really well. So
car festival?
Yeah. So it was classic cars. It was really cool.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Alexandria is growing just like other regions, cities and parts of the region. But every jurisdiction has got to do something more about cars, though. We just can't have everybody have a car.
No, absolutely. So. You know, we're trying to encourage people to use other modes of transportation, and I don't want to get ahead of ourselves, but, you know, with the WMATA shutdown and everything, I know there was a lot of people using the water taxi and had never used it before, myself included, and so we're trying to look at different modes of transportation.
Well, Alexandria's pilot program for dockless electric scooters, speaking of other modes of transportation, was extended until the end of this year. Mayor Justin Wilson recently said that what he's hearing from his constituents is that the scooters have, quoting here, either destroyed our city as we know it or are a welcome transportation alternative. Where do you fall on this scooter question?
Well, I think it's somewhere in between because, honestly, I don't think the regulations and the technology have caught up to what it is exactly. I do like the idea of the scooters, especially with the whole concept of the last mile home. One of the big concerns that I know my colleague, Councilman Seifeldine, is looking into is the environmental impact and how long do these scooters last? And
the environmental impact of a scooter?
Because of the batteries, and if they're not being used for longer than, say, a month, what happens to all the parts, right?
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, scooters, you know, everyone refers to them, as Kojo just did, as dockless scooters. Of course, cars are kind of dockless, too, because they park anywhere the hell they want. And, but, you know, there is a micro, it's called micro transit. You've got to accommodate people who are going short distances.
Yeah.
But on a longer, a metro, I was just reading, there have been plans, not plans, discussions and studies by WMATA to extend Metro, with all these stations reopening soon, you know, next week or so, Metro across the Wilson Bridge to National Harbor. Is that going to be something that is even on the agenda of the Alexandria Council? We'd go from Alexandria to National Harbor. The Wilson Bridge was redone, and it was built in order to provide rapid transit, but it hasn't been done because it costs too much.
I mean, that's the first I hear about a metro extension from Alexandria to National Harbor.
Okay. So that means it's not high on the list of Alexandria issues. Back to scooters.
Well, wait, before we get back to scooters, Kay Stimson, the president of the North Ridge Civic Association, emailed in to say, does the council member intend to stand in support with the 11 Alexandria Civic Associations representing 8,000-plus households in maintaining four traffic lanes along Seminary Road when the council vote on the city staff's recommendation on September 14th?
Ooh.
All right, so jumping right into it.
It's a yes or no question right there.
Well, first of all, I live in that community, right, when we're talking about Seminary Road. And last year, I actually walked that route, and we saw a little bit of everything, people running lights, the bikes riding on the sidewalks because they don't feel comfortable on the road. So there's a lot of things that are going into this, and people are very passionate about it on both sides to reduce it to three lanes and, of course, the other side to keep it to four lanes. And I've been at the community meetings. I've met with residents from both sides of the issue, and there's still a lot of information coming in. So I the thing is, at the end of the day, as a community, it's our responsibility to you know, ensure safe and reliable mobility for all our residents across the city, whether you're walking, biking, scootering, taking the bus, or driving.
I didn't hear a yes or a no.
You guys will have to tune in to the city council meeting.
Okay.
Well, you have those four lanes. That's four lanes there now, right?
And, two lanes in each direction,
and
yes.
Is Duke Street also? I was out for something. I've forgotten what on Duke Street. It's like four or lanes or more.
On both sides.
And but the speed limit is 25.
On Seminary.
In the Seminary, it is also 25?
On Duke Street, certain portions are 25, but other portions are 35.
Of course, no one goes 25.
And, you know, part of the concept behind a road diet, if you will, is that by making it one lane, as long as you have one person going the speed limit, everybody else is going to be going the speed limit behind you.
Or passing illegally.
I don't know if people aren't too encouraged to go into oncoming traffic, so I don't know about that.
I don't know. I've seen some pretty outrageous behavior of people who get stuck behind one-lane traffic.
2 weeks ago, the real estate website Redfin said that Alexandria and Arlington County have the most competitive housing markets in the country. While there is still debate over just what is causing that competition, the effects are clear. More demand, less supply, housing staying on the market for less time and selling above the list price. Mm-hmm. In light of all of this, how do you think the city should ensure that its affordable housing stock grows and stays, well, affordable?
Yeah, this is a huge issue in the city, and we talked about it a little bit last time, but I'm actually really excited because I'm going to a national convening down in Durham, North Carolina in October, and we're going to be discussing different strategies for not only preserving affordable housing, but trying to create new affordable housing. And it's a mix of financing, it's a mix of zoning, it's a mix of talking with the community so that they're on board, and also working within our own constraints as a state, right? Because in Virginia, we're a Dillon Rule state, so we have to work within those constraints. Although we all know in November, the situation might change a little bit at the state level, so we have to keep an eye on that as well.
Well, when you announced in February of 2018, you said affordable housing was the most important issue in your campaign. But studying it, yes, going to the event in North Carolina, or whatever, is there an idea of what you think needs to happen? Is it just a matter of spending more money, of setting aside affordable housing, workforce housing? You must have some ideas of what you want to do, and if you're not sure, ready yet to say what you will do.
Yeah. I think, you know, we definitely have to look at mixed use, creating density. But when we're creating density, it's very counterintuitive because people are talking about cars again, right?
Right.
When we're creating density, we have to make sure that we're putting the proper infrastructure in place with retail and services. So people just have to walk within their community, and then the transportation infrastructure as well, because in that way, people are not isolated within the region. They can still get to different places.
And again, it can't be car centric.
Exactly.
Here, Paul called in to ask, what is Kanek-Agirre doing to preserve the property values of the West End in Alexandria? So you're not dealing only with people who want affordable housing. You're dealing with people who apparently don't want their property values to drop in the West End.
I don't see that happening with some of the development that we have going and the potential for our transit corridors that we want to put in along Beauregard and Duke Street, some of the funding that we're going to be getting from the state to look into some of those things. I think there's a lot of opportunity in the West End. And again, we have to make sure that infrastructure is in place because we're not forcing people out of their cars. We're encouraging people to look at other modes of transportation. So I think the real estate values will still be going.
Again, other modes of transportation. At a roundtable this Monday with leaders from Northern Virginia, Arlington County Board Member Christian Dorsey, who is also on the WMATA board, said he wants to see, quoting here, see the attention to Metro's buses that is paid to rail. Where do you think buses should be fitting into transit solutions?
Buses are extremely important. Part of the thing is, if people don't think they're reliable or that they're going to be on time, they're not going to use it. So we have to make sure that they're reliable, they're on time, and that they're frequent, right?
Because when dedicated lanes?
I would love to see more dedicated lanes. You know, we have a partial bus rapid transit with a dedicated lane in Alexandria. We're hoping to try and create something similar on the West End as well, and maybe in the future on the Duke corridor as well.
You know, many people do depend upon the buses to get to jobs and to other things, see family members. But buses have a sense that many people of means who can have a car or do something else feel it's kind of a step down to ride a bus. One thing you have to do is change the reputation of buses, in addition to having them be on time, to make sure they're clean, that they're available.
Absolutely. I think that's a big point there.
Well, with the closure of the metro stations, the metro rail stations recently, apparently there was a significant increase in bus ridership that we saw. You were named in May to El Tiempo Latino's Power Meter 100 list. This list honors the 100 most influential people in the local Latino community.
What number was he? Let's be
good question.
Do you know what number you were?
They put us in alphabetical order, okay. So apparently I'm around number one.
You're around number one because his name starts with A.
Well, okay. Sorry, excuse me for interrupting.
You were born and raised in L.A. Your parents are Mexican immigrants, but you've been in Alexandria since 2011, and you've been in office since the beginning of this year. What has your experience been representing Latino and immigrant communities in Alexandria?
You know, I think this is an important time for the Latino community and the DMV as a whole. It's a very interesting point. We're kind of at that critical mass point where the Latino community has graduated from high school, graduated from college, created businesses, and now we have that base of support to kind of go out and start taking some more political action. The thing in Alexandria and looking, of course, at the national level with what's going on with administration, I think it's extremely important for local politicians to be protective of their communities, to show the impact and the benefit of immigrant communities. And so it's been a pleasure to be working with lots of different groups, such as Tenants and Workers United in the city of Alexandria, New Virginia Majority at the state level, to make sure that those protections are in place, and also to highlight you know, the benefits of having the immigrant community, the culture that they bring, the food, the diversity, and the economic benefit, of course, as well.
You did work as an interpreter for the immigrant community. Are there enough interpreters to make sure that people of different languages and cultures can understand what's happening in your city, in Alexandria?
There's never enough interpreters, right? I think it's something that we're working towards, but it is a very crucial role, especially when you talk about in our school system in Alexandria, there's over 100 languages that are spoken. So we're constantly trying to see how we could be inclusive as possible.
I was seeing that on September 14th, there's a second annual annual Taste of Ethiopia in Alexandria. And I tell people all the time, you go to Montgomery County, wherever, there are like 100 languages spoken mm-hmm. everywhere, I'm sure in the district too. But you still don't see, and even with the deaf community in the city, there's not enough interpretation sign language for, mm-hmm. so everyone knows what's going on.
Yeah.
There is a great deal of fear in the immigrant community because of the current political climate. How do you think that'll affect, especially where you are, the 2020 census?
So I'm glad you bring that up. I'm actually the chair of the Complete Count Committee. We have
the Complete Count Committee
is for that the city of Alexandria.
That's an official group or a social group?
It's an official group
okay.
for the city.
Okay,
yeah,
good.
It's our official census committee to okay. get a complete count in the city. You know, I think one of the biggest things is to have trusted messengers within the community, whether they're speaking Amharic, Arabic, or Spanish, and folks that you see in your neighborhood, folks that you see at the bus stop, folks that you see at the grocery store. This is the way we're going to get people and encourage them to take the census, right? Because it's still, they feel that risk, they feel that fear, and we have to show them that it's safe, it's easy, and it's secure because, you know, there is case law that says that they cannot share any information from the census data. Granted, I know the administration that we're dealing with, but this is the what we're working with and the messaging that we're trying to use.
It seems that Ken Cuccinelli, who is the former Attorney General of Virginia now, is in an immigrant position for the Trump administration, is being much more aggressive. You know, he made that horrific remark about the Statue of Liberty quotation. Mm-hmm. We only want people who can sustain themselves, and there's the new rules about people who are here for medical reasons who may have to reapply to stay here, and that it's you can understand why people are not just fearful, they are frightened, they really truly are withdrawing from society in many respects, because any exposure to a hospital or to a school or to a library puts them a target on their backs or on their fronts.
And if I could piggyback on that, the whole thing with the public charge is not helping either. October 15th, I know there's pending litigation, but I mean you're taking away critical services for individuals that they need. And because of the fear, they're saying, well, I'm not going to try and get any or access any of these services. So it's a very frightening time, but, you know, we have to put in as many supports as possible.
Tara emails, and I'm a resident of Alexandria. Will the trolley still run on King Street, or are you moving it to another road? What will you do with King Street traffic? As a resident on Prince, I don't want more traffic going in front of my house. It's already strained.
I have never heard about moving the trolley off of King Street, so I'm pretty sure we're keeping it there, and I would advocate to keep it there as well.
Well, you mentioned the elections coming up on November the 5th, the all-year elections. Every Senate and House seat is up. I looked at Alexandria. There are 28 Senate or House seats that are affecting in Alexandria or parts of Alexandria. Of those 28, only 9 are contested. Mm. And so the Democrats hold a substantial lead in all of those. In the House, there are 19 seats and only 6 are opposed. In the Senate, there are 9 seats and only 3 are opposed. It seems to me the Democrats have a great expectation that you're going to flip some more seats and you're going to take the House and the Senate. Where are the races in the contested races in Alexandria? Tim Hugo, Dan Helmer is running against Tim Hugo. What races do you think people should be looking at as we head to November the 5th?
I think that's a good one. Dan Helmer down in Virginia Beach, there's one I think in the 99th or the 100th. Mm-hmm. Phil Hernandez is running. But I mean, within the city proper of Alexandria, all of our folks are pretty much safe because we have 5 people in our delegation. I think only Senator Barker is being contested. I think he has a strong group, though, in the city of Alexandria and parts of Prince William and Fairfax, though.
I was just going to say, so the Northern Virginia Democrats, again, will lead the way to Richmond?
We're leading the way, but we're hoping to get some help from the other parts of the city, state as well.
Finally, we got an email from Larry. Council and staff seem to focus on increasing residential development, but there's a major tax-based disparity with such a small percentage of revenue coming from businesses. What will the council do to rebalance the tax revenue to increase the business tax base?
Huge issue. We've had an imbalance for a long time, and part of the difficulty is land is at a premium in the city, and where do we create? Where can we build some of this commercial base? And that's part of the importance of the Potomac Yard Metro, right? We're going down to Richmond on September 6th to get our last permit to try and push this forward from the Department of Environmental Quality and the Water Control Board. And this is an area in Potomac Yard where we could try and create some more of that commercial base to help, even out that percentage, if you will.
Kanik Aguirre, he's an Alexandria City Council member. He's a Democrat. Thank you so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, guys.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll be talking with Howard County Executive Calvin Ball. You can start calling with your questions or comments for him now, 800-433-8850. I'm Kojo Namdi.
Hi, it's Diane. The next meeting of my book club is on Wednesday, May 31st at 1 p.m. Eastern. I'll host a discussion of Mad Honey by Jodi Picco and Jennifer Finney Boylan, followed by a conversation with the authors. Find out more and register at dianereem.org/bookclub.
Welcome back. This is, of course, the Politics Hour. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a contributing writer for Washington City Paper. And joining us in studio now is Howard County Executive Calvin Ball. He is a Democrat. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, and welcome to all the listeners.
Tom Sherwood, in Montgomery County, County Executive Mark Elrich is apparently going to nominate Darrell McSwain as the next Montgomery County Police Chief. McSwain only retired from the Montgomery County Police after 30 years last year. He's currently Chief of the Maryland National Capital Park Service Montgomery County Division. I guess the surprise, however, earlier was when the county executive's nominee, Tonya Chapman, had withdrawn herself from consideration, apparently because of so much chatter surrounding her time as Chief in Portsmouth, Virginia.
You know, this has been a big setback for the county executive. You know, he did a big search and considered a variety of people. Tonya Chapman's name came out, but she did have a terrible time in Portsmouth. She wrote a 4-page memo back then about the assault when she left that job, the assault on her, the racism of Portsmouth. She sent out an email to all the police officers who were grumbling about her. It just seemed like an unpleasant fit for Montgomery County, and she surprisingly withdrew. But it was not so surprising to people who were paying attention, because not one council member in the county council of Montgomery had said anything positive about her, and she was answering 40-page questionnaire, and it did not look good for her, so she withdrew. Elrich said that he was disappointed that she might be considered for another job in another jurisdiction, but he would move ahead. And he hasn't yet appointed or nominated Darrell McSwain, but already council members are publicly saying this is the right choice. This is someone who knows Montgomery County, who has the integrity, can address the issues of both running a 1,300-member force, but also the racial concerns that had been raised in the last couple of years in Montgomery County about how police were treating minorities. And, of course, this is to replace Tom Manger, who had held the job for 15 years, and it's one of the most important jobs that Mr. Elrich will fill.
I know Mr. Elrich wanted the Tacoma Park Police Chief, who was one of the finalists for this position, to apply for it. And then the Tacoma Park Police Chief said, I just remembered how wonderful Tacoma Park is.
And I think he has, yes, I'm sorry, his name is escaping me now, but he has like 40 police officers in Potomac. So I think that's what happened there.
All right, on to Calvin Ball. Last weekend, a natural gas explosion did major damage to a commercial building in Columbia. What's the latest on the recovery operation there?
So at about 7:30, our Department of Fire and Rescue Services got a call for a gas leak. They went in, they were able to ascertain that there was a gas leak. They put together a perimeter, and then at about 8 a.m. on Sunday, there was the explosion. It's a good thing that they were able to put that perimeter up, and we had no injuries or deaths. People are having a lot of challenges moving forward. About 22 businesses were adversely impacted. We're working with our Economic Development Authority and our Office of Workforce Development for the displaced workers. BG&E is working to do an investigation, and we are going to continue to move forward as a united Howard County.
Well, yesterday,
what does move forward mean? Sounds like we're playing chess, but has the county had to commit monies to this other than the emergency personnel who responded? Has there a move to some of these smaller businesses to move them, to help them move and save money or not have fewer losses? What's moving forward mean?
So working with the businesses, those who want to potentially be in other locations during this time of transition, those who we had a very controlled and brief time for them to go in and get some of their most valuable possessions, paperwork, what have you. Move forward means helping those displaced workers with maybe other job opportunities, seeing which aspects or which portions of the explosion people might be able to go into sooner rather than later, working with the property manager on ensuring that anything that we can do is luckily they had insurance. And so, you know, some may not return. Where might they want to find other locations in Howard County? We're working with them on that. So,
Pretty comprehensive.
Yesterday, you and Governor Hogan hosted a press conference announcing a land deal to help with Ellicott City mitigation costs after two floods did serious damage over the past few years. What are the broad outlines of that plan?
So, as we know, in recent time, in 2011, 2016, 2018, we had significant flooding in Ellicott City. The last time we had flooding, there was actually monies taken away from moving the Waterloo Fire Station forward. That fire station is something that, as a council member, I've been working with our county executives and the fire department to move forward for about a decade. And so $3.5 million was shifted from that project, which caused a minor delay. And in talking with the governor, he was very gracious. Within my first 30 days, we sat and we talked about a myriad of issues, including Ellicott City and the fire station. And so being able to actually make that deal for a dollar and then moving forward with that station while moving flood mitigation projects forward in Ellicott City was critical.
Well, Tom Sherwood did a personal inspection of the Ellicott City environment, if you will, this week, so I'll leave the rest up to him.
Can I give a commercial endorsement to the Manor Hill Tavern chicken sandwich? Chicken sandwich that I had there in Ellicott City.
You just did.
Randy Mariner, you know, because all that big fighting about whether Popeyes or Wendy's or whoever has the best chicken sandwich, I think Manor Hill Tavern worked out pretty well. Most of the people who were eating it when I was there had to take half of it home.
I thought you were looking around Ellicott.
Well, in addition to eating and getting fatter, I did walk up and down in Ellicott City. I hadn't been there in some time. I talked to some of the construction workers, some of the businesses that were opening Tuesday morning. You've got a big plan, an expensive plan. I want to ask you about the funding for it in a moment. But there's a lot of work being done. But if there were another 1,000-year flood and again soon, it looks like they would still be subject, those businesses that are being rebuilt, that the county is rebuilding, would still be subject to serious flooding. I know the doors are stronger, the windows are stronger, but where is it in terms of protecting Ellicott City? This is Labor Day weekend. It's a popular time for people to come there as tourists and visit. I'm sure you want them to go, and there's certainly things to see. But where are you if there were another storm in the next couple of weeks or months? Wouldn't a lot of this new work just be wiped out again?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for coming to visit and patronize Ellicott City. It is a fantastic place that people come from all over the world to visit, and it's our second largest economic driver in the county.
Well, you answered one of my questions, which was, you're going to all this expense. Is it significant enough, Ellicott City? I talked to Mark DeLuca, your chief engineer, about how it sits there and this steep drop-off and what's the tunnel you want to build to divert water. But is it significant? It's not just a little town in Howard County. It is economically significant.
Economically and culturally significant. You know, Ellicott City is a special place, as are all of the areas of Howard County. And we have been moving forward with a plan that is not only a plan to address flood mitigation for today, but into tomorrow. I was talking with someone recently about the increased flooding due to more intensity and frequency of storms all around the world. And they said, you know, this plan will actually be a blueprint and could help people in not only all the 3,069 counties in the nation, but throughout the world. The previous plan would have left about 4.5 feet of flood water on Lower Main Street in the 100-year storm. Our new
Mr. Kittleman's plan, the county executive you defeated.
Our new safe and sound plan now leaves less than a foot of flood water in that same 100-year storm. And to your point about what's been going on since then, if there were to be an issue, not only have we continued moving forward with those flood mitigation projects, as well as starting an emergency public alert system, just making sure that people know what's going on, and clearing our waterways. Before I took office, quarterly, we would clear the waterways. And I worked with our team to institute a program. Whenever there is a significant weather event, we would clear the waterways. And already, since I've been in office, we've cleared more than 8 tons of debris. And so a lot of these mitigation access points to higher ground, a lot of these mitigation efforts are things that will make us safer and more sound.
But there is pushback. After last year's flood, the county placed a 12-month moratorium on development in historic Ellicott City, which you recently extended by 3 months. Councilmember Liz Walsh has proposed legislation that would stop developers from building on certain land in the historic district and would protect nearby forests. She says that your proposal on stormwater management would allow developers to keep building on sensitive land so long as they pay fees, limiting how effective the flood mitigation will really be. How do you respond?
So I was supportive and voted for the moratorium that was in place, and I actually was also supportive of the extension. The goal of the moratorium was never to end development. The goal of the moratorium was to ensure that we developed in a smarter, safer way. And so since then, I have pre-filed 2 pieces of legislation. In particular, just this week and previously some other legislation. The first will strengthen stormwater management requirements, ensuring that development needs to manage to the storm level of 2016. So frankly, if they are to develop, they need to develop so that there is no disturbance or things are even better. And it will reduce runoff and mitigate flooding.
A lot of the complaints are is that all the development above Ellicott City and around Ellicott City, which had been forest land and farmland and, mm-hmm. and trees, became impervious because concrete was laid, streets were laid, buildings were built, and so the water has nowhere to go. So under this new plan, it would be that if you're going to build something, you have to incorporate something never been done before, which is you have to figure out where the hell is the water going when you build something.
Yeah, we want, if there is going to be development to take place, for it to not adversely impact the environment. And then the second is our fees and lieus.
Fees and lieu? That sounds like a dance.
Fees and lieu. Fees and lieu.
Hopefully we're
so,
we're
dancing. If you don't fix it, you pay more fees so something else will be done.
Correct. Okay. So the current fees are $72,000 per acre foot. The new legislation will raise it to $175,000 per acre foot. So, and that's only if the stormwater management facilities cannot be accommodated on site. And then those dollars will go toward flood mitigation efforts in the watershed.
Got to take a short break, but when we come back, I don't think we'll be able to talk about flood mitigation much longer because all of our calls and all of our emails have to do with two things, schools and ice. So we'll be addressing those issues when we come back. If you want to get through, send us a tweet at Kojo Show or email to kojo@wamu.org. I'm Kojo Nand. Welcome back. Our guest is Calvin Ball. He is the Howard County Executive. And Tom Sherwood, you had one quick question left about Ellicott City flooding.
Part of the plan is to build a big tunnel to divert water off the main road. But the question I had when I was there is, how are you going to pay for it? Have you found funding for all of this yet?
Well, just like we do any other capital project, we're going to work with our partners. We'll do some bond funding. We have, since I've been in office, worked with our state partners. I mean, just like the $3.5 million wasn't previously allocated. So we are going to move forward, and we're going to do the best thing to keep Ellicott City safe and safe.
Well, just let the record show. That's the fourth time he said move forward. I'm just keeping track.
Next week,
here.
Howard County students head back to school. Superintendent Michael Martorano recently released a redistricting plan that would move more than 7,300 students to different schools. It's meant to alleviate overcrowding and address inequities in the school system. Got a bunch of calls and emails about it, but what do you think of the superintendent's plans?
Well, I think that it's important to have comprehensive redistricting. A couple years ago, there was a proposal from Dr. Martorano to move about 8,000 students. We ended up moving about 2,000. Right now, we have some schools that are over 130% capacity. And so we have children who might even have difficulty finding space in the lunchroom. Conversely, we have other schools that are under 70% capacity. We have some schools that have free and reduced meal rates of over 40% of the school and others that are below 5%, so low that it's not being calculated. I think that we should, to the extent possible, keep neighborhoods together. I think that there should be a thoughtful redistricting program, but it needs to be comprehensive. And so I think Dr. Martorano has put forward a proposal. The Board of Ed will be spending most of the fall evaluating that, going through a transparent process where people can weigh in, and then making their determination about mid to late November.
Now, who makes the final decision, the school board or the council?
The school board.
Okay.
So the superintendent makes his proposal to the school board. The school board makes the determination.
An op-ed in the Baltimore Sun this week said the plan, with quoting here, spread poverty across the system. So, that said, here is Jita in Ellicott City, who seems to have a similar concern. Jita, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Okay. Actually, just wanted to know, what is the role of county executive in creating equity in the county, rather than, you know, the superintendent is doing that by moving the students around and creating more transportation and environmental issues in Ellicott City, which will be a problem in the future. So, and I think there is going to be a redistricting again in 2 years. So it's an ongoing problem. What is the role of county executive in this?
Dr. Ball.
So I believe that it's all of our responsibility to ensure that we have the best quality of life for all of our residents, no matter what their station is in life, whether it's race, religion, socioeconomic level. Just this spring, I, with my team of our Department of Resources and Community Resources and Services and Recreation and Parks, actually put forward an equity plan. So there, and it can be found online, there are numerous aspects that we have a role in when it comes to equity. And I believe when it comes to the policy related to redistricting, that is one of the factors that they're considering.
People move to neighborhoods because of the reputation of the school systems. Would this plan say to them that no matter where you might live, you stand a chance of having your child move out of your neighborhood to a similar or close by neighborhood, maybe, but being in a neighborhood doesn't guarantee you the right to go to the school where you've moved?
Well, I think, we have a Howard
That's
County.
That's a great fear from people.
Well, we have a Howard County school system. So it's the entirety of the system. There are people not only around the state or the region, but around the world who are today advertising, come from wherever to come to a Howard County school. While there are definitely opportunities for improvements for all of our schools when it comes to teaching and learning environments, I think that there are so many people outside of Howard County who would love to come to any Howard County public school.
Well, Alex and Shane have similar concerns. Alex called in regarding, quoting here, the disastrous school redistricting plan just put forward. How does Dr. Ball plan to pay for the transportation and busing of students through insanely gerrymandered school districts? And Shane emailed to say, how will the county executive pay for double or triple school bus costs? And how will busing our kids around improve educational performance?
So transportation is an issue in Howard County. The Board of Ed is an elected body, and so they actually create their own budget proposal after the superintendent gives his recommendations, and they evaluate how they will prioritize, whether it's education whether it's busing or transportation or what have you. I do think that transportation and time to get to school should be a consideration.
Well, on the other hand, here's Maura in Ellicott City. Maura, your turn.
Hi, I'm a former Howard County Public School teacher and parent of five kids in the school system. And I just have seen the racial and socioeconomic segregation in our schools continue. And I'm seeing recently the vitriol in our community and the backlash against the county resolution, as well as the equity goals of the Board of Ed. So I'm wondering, so many people have a counter narrative to what we're hearing in the community that's really not positive. What's the best way to offer support for these efforts and support the Board of Education, support Dr. Monterano and some of the county council members who have come out saying that equity needs to be a priority? How do we do that?
Great question. It is unfortunate that this conversation in many parts has become so negative. I think that it is realistic and appropriate to have questions, concerns, to talk about different proposals that might meet all of our goals. But I think pitting schools against each other, talking about negatively about our children and our educators is not as productive. I think if there are issues and challenges, which there are in many of our schools, let's work together to address those. I think that's a much more productive conversation.
This is clearly whether New York City, which has the most segregated schools in the country, people say, to the District of Columbia, has a lot of out-of-bound students, to anywhere, the racial, socioeconomic issue is a fundamental issue. It's like addressing racism in the country. It's a pretty tough task, but you say the county's going to do it.
It is a tough task, and I think that we all have a role in trying to make things better.
Well, here's the other issue people seem to be concerned about. Anna emails asking for County Executive Ball to address what she calls the, quoting here, lack of transparency in ICE funding at the Howard County Detention Center, she says. According to an article in the Columbia Flyer, Howard County has received $14 million in revenue since 2013. Is this the total amount received without considering costs? What is the actual profit to the county? Is the Howard County Detention Center dependent on this funding for its operations? Then there's Richard, who emailed, why haven't the contracts with ICE been canceled? Why is Howard County operating a concentration camp to put innocent people in jail in our county? This is very disappointing. And here now, finally, is Leslie in Columbia, Maryland, who identifies as the chair of the Friends of Latin America of Howard County. Leslie, you're on the air. We don't have a great deal of time left, but go ahead, please.
Thank you so much, Gojo. I was at the Howard County Detention Center yesterday with several groups concerned about the fear that ICE causes in our community. Since I speak Spanish, I was able to talk to a few young men, Mexico, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras, who are in jail. What they told me is not what the Howard County officials told us about the conditions that they live in. But even if they were in a five-star jail, their rights have already been violated by ICE when they detain people primarily because of the way they
look. Like I said, we don't have a great deal of time left.
See, I'm finishing. So this violates Howard County non-discrimination laws. So my question is, why do we have a contract with such an agency? We do want all people in our community to be safe, but without fear. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
So, first of all, Howard County police officers do not and will not assist ICE in civil immigration laws, enforcing civil immigration laws. I also went to the detention center yesterday, and there are four criteria that have people who are there when it comes to ICE. They have to be convicted of crimes. They have to be charged with jailable offenses, members of criminal gangs, or deported criminal felons who have illegally reentered. I looked at the charges of everyone who is currently in the detention center, and they range from DUI, DWI, to numerous sexual offenses, first-degree assault, many other very concerning things. We spend about $20 million for our detention center annually. The ICE contracts are between $2 and $3 million. There is no profit in working with ICE, and there is no way that we are going to be able to stop what President Trump and ICE are doing. If people are arrested and detained via ICE, they will go somewhere. And I believe in Howard County, they are getting the best treatment possible.
Does your county hold people who's legally could be released, except that ICE wants you to hold them?
Those are the four criteria. These are criminals who
have
been
convicted. But if by the court says they can be released, do you hold them because ICE says hold them?
If they are convicts at that time, sometimes we do.
And I'm afraid that's about all the time we have. Today's Politics Hour was produced by Mark Gunnery. Today is Mark's last day with the show, and we're very sad to see him go. He's been the force behind the Politics Hour and our resident music and culture guru for the past 2 years. But he will be continuing his public radio journey in his beloved hometown of Baltimore, and they're very lucky to have him. So since he's going back home to Baltimore, we thought we would say farewell to Mark in a particularly Baltimorean kind of way. We're going to have lemon sticks, to which Mark introduced us, and he told us that this is a terrific delicacy in Baltimore, Maryland. Mark Gunnery, could you explain what lemon sticks are? Can I have one?
Yes, yeah, sure. A lemon stick is a half a lemon with a soft peppermint stick put inside of it, in that it kind of turns into a straw from the citric acid if you...
Does President Trump know about this?
I'm not sure.
Can you demonstrate for our audience how this is consumed so they can hear it?
Yeah,
I'll be doing
so
the same
thing. Sucking on the soft peppermint stick. Yeah, that sounds good.
He can make the sound.
Yeah,
I
this
can.
Is ASMR for y'all.
Mm-hmm. What alcohol goes with this? Because surely it has to be more than this, unless it's for 5-year-olds.
Probably vodka.
Okay.
See, that's the skeptic in Tom Short.
You really got to work on it for about 20 minutes.
I don't think I do anything.
Have you ever
minutes.
Had a lemon stick before?
I have.
I figure you're close enough to Baltimore that you would know about
that's
it.
That's right.
Yes, this is a Baltimore delicacy.
So may I just very briefly give a shout out to Athelton High School. I was there today. I promised them I would, and wish everyone a very happy Labor Day and appreciate everybody who works so hard.
And lemon sticks for all of you.
That's right.
Mark, thank you very much for all the hard work. The Politics Hour will not be the same without you. So we wish you the best of luck in Baltimore, even though we hate to see you go.
Well, thank you, Kojo, and thank you, Tom. And
Mark
thank you, everyone
loses
here.
A customer.
We will be off for the holiday weekend. Any big plans, Tom Sherwood?
I'm going to enjoy the weekend. I'm going to go up somewhere in Maryland for a 45th wedding anniversary of someone who doesn't want to be mentioned because she won't come on this show.
Well, make sure you go by Ellicott City again. They
That's
love you.
Right.
They love you there. Galvin Ball is the Howard County Executive. He's a Democrat. Dr. Ball, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you all for listening. Have a great weekend. I'm Kojo Nand.
The Kojo Namdi Show is produced by Ruth Tam, Mark Gunnery, Margaret Barthel, Sydney Grannon, and Maura Curry. Our managing producer is Angelisa Schroepsdorf. Our senior producer is Mana Kashvi. Our engineer is Ben Privett, and our intern is Kayla Hewitt. For past shows and more content, visit kojoshow.org.
WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kodjo Namdi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.